I mentioned from the bank for doing that, and then we actually turn around and loan a big portion of that, a lot of times anywhere as high as half of that, back to the project. So even though we're taking a maximum 15 fee, we're really donating a lot back. And that's sort of a problem, I think, when we were in the Meyer Memorial Trust work group, is the program is very challenging and nuanced. So I do think you're right. I think it's a good idea for us to probably add and explain, because even hearing that we get a 15% fee sounds really high, but when you really look at the nuances of it, we're not realizing that fee.
I also just want to put up a caution flag, because we went through this a number of years ago in the Housing Bureau during a recession. We have to be careful when we're shifting risk and costs onto the backs of nonprofits that we are not penny wise and pound foolish. And you can scrub a pro forma, you can take a hard line, you can take some things out. What then often happens is years later, that same partner comes back to the city asking for relief. And if you structure a deal in a certain way, you're almost guaranteed they're going to come back and seek refinance, gap contributions, all kinds of relief. And of course, the Housing Bureau now has a flexible tool to do that. We do it; the Bureau does it regularly. But I think one of the things we have to be careful about is what's the cost of driving down, about changing the pro forma and the math on some of these projects. Because what you may be doing, like a classic example is a reserve fund for recapitalization. It is possible to start perhaps saying we're going to put less money aside in our reserves. Well, we can do that, but let's also recognize the city now, as a matter of policy, is going exactly the opposite direction. We don't open a park without building in the O&M. We have sometimes criticized for not maintaining our infrastructure. So the idea that we would, as a way of reducing costs at the front end, simply have an IOU that gets bigger and bigger later that we have to deal with is not necessarily the most responsible way to finance a project. So that may just be another way of saying this is incredibly complicated, and whatever you do at the front end may have a back end consequence.
Commissioner, the one last thing I'd add to the hard cost discussion, we did delve a little bit into the world of innovative design, finance, and construction, not as much as I think we would have all liked to. And so there was some interesting conversation around modular and factory-built housing as a model that hasn't really been proven in Oregon. All the projects that have been built or been proposed in Oregon that I'm aware of are essentially prototypes, so the costs are not especially low. But it is possible to build the main part of units in a factory down in the valley, truck them up here and essentially bolt them together and hook up the plumbing and electrical. And in theory, you should be able to do that at a lower cost. And the barriers to doing that at a lower cost are several. One of them is just creating a reliable pipeline for the factory so that they can actually deliver units at a lower per unit cost. So that's something that I think lots of people would like to see more of. But the folks involved in the affordable housing world, lenders, public funders, are not notoriously risk tolerant, so they may not be the ones to step up and want to prove the concept, but I think we would all like to see more in that respect. And there are parts of the country where this is happening on a bigger scale. With that, I think we can turn to the soft cost discussion, and we've got into this a little bit already. This is where the biggest difference, I think, lives between affordable projects and market rate projects. The soft costs are definitely higher on an affordable project. We've talked about many of the reasons for that. Part of it is the complexity of the project. When you have a dozen different partners on a deal, you have kind of a little risk management premium for every partner that walks in the room. They're going to bring their attorney, and the attorney's going to have the meter running. And if you could make projects simpler, you'd make them a little cheaper. That's part of it. We've called out here the four big categories in soft costs that people often refer to. So legal is one of them, and I've had several people say to me, we've got to find a way to cap those legal fees or at least contain them somehow. Architecture and engineering, some people would say, well, we should just do cookie-cutter projects, the same ones over and over again. I think there are reasons not to do that, but it's a complicated discussion. We didn't bring one of our architects, but they wouldn't like that idea very much. The developer fee we've talked about, and we can talk about that in a little more detail. Capitalized reserves, the commissioner just ably addressed. And then there are all sorts of other soft costs. So there are traffic studies and engineering studies and all sorts of things that pile up. And if your funders are not aligned, you may have to go get another traffic study. Or if your funding didn't come through in 2014, you may have to go get a traffic study in 2016 when your funding does come through. So those things really start to pile up a little bit. It's not obvious how you would reduce these costs. We get to some ideas in the recommendations section. With that, I would actually move ahead to design. Is there anything else that the two of you, Jess and Jill, want to say about soft costs, or did we pretty much beat that one to death? Maybe the architecture one is worth talking about a little bit.
So, I mean, it seems like we've covered them pretty well. I mean, architecture fees are, we typically pay a percentage. I'm sort of blanking on the percentage right now. To our architects, like it's been already mentioned, I mean, we typically are not building, like what Dave said, where they have an approved design, where they're doing it, you know, the same every building. We usually are responding to neighborhood concerns. We're typically in opportunity areas where we are going through the design commission, may have to go more than once. So our architecture fees are I'm sure, higher than Dave's, but we haven't done them. I don't think we've broken down exactly the difference of that. So Jill, you might have a good perspective.
I would say that in some cases there is a slight premium for an affordable project, and it really has to do, I think, more with, there's typically a number of different groups in a for-profit agency that are engaged in the process. There also may be a board of directors that's engaged in the process. There's typically community process that may be beyond what you might have in a typical market rate development. And so I do think there might be, in some cases, a slight premium that an architect is charging to cover that additional time, as opposed to a more streamlined process where you may have one person in a market rate deal that basically kind of makes decisions and moves the process forward.
I would say that I've worked for OTAC as their director of housing and community development in throughout North America. And one of the best cost containment strategies is design build, where the architect and the contractor and the developer have an identity of interest, so that the architect is actually part of the team to begin with, and that they can design to a budget that the developer originates. So that cuts down on redesigns significantly. Doesn't remove, perhaps, bumps along the road due to design review that might be unexpected later in the design process, but to the extent possible, developers like to shift cost burdens onto their other partners, and that's one way to do it. Many designers, and Nozad Othman, the founder of OTAC, did this famously. I mean, that was his business model. They would procure long-term relationship with developers by self-funding design development and conceptual design work for their folks, and sometimes we waited 3 years to get paid on projects.
I would say one thing that Reached us, and I think a lot of the other affordable developers do this as well, is what's called integrated design. So we start very early on with our architect and contractor. We do talk about our target budget from day one, and we do try to work as a team to make sure that we are designing to that budget. So the intent is always to really manage that really tightly. But, of course, there are things like the time delays or the planning commission or things that, you know, can throw that off and extend both time and cost. But the intention is always to be as quick and succinct as possible.
So that's all a very nice segue to the next slide I had, which was design as a cost driver and how good is good enough. And we got to a place where we build really beautiful, affordable housing in Oregon and in Portland in particular. And part of that is we've learned from past mistakes. We're building in quality and durability, and everybody has an interest in quality. The neighbors, the developer, the lenders, the public funders all want to see a building that's going to last essentially forever. And we've learned life cycle costs are important. It's worth it sometimes, as someone asked, to build in more at the front end because it will pay off in a short amount of time. There's also that intense competition for funding at the state, and so there is a beauty contest aspect that people have talk to me about, where you want to bring in a building that's got some pizzazz because it's so hard to get the funding. And so there's sort of this creep in the sense of higher and higher levels of design quality. This is a touchy subject, but I guess there is a question: could you attain an acceptable level of quality and durability at a lower cost? And I don't think there's a magical answer to that, but I think part of the way the group approached that is if the public funders incentivize cost efficiency and cost containment, and delivering units at a lower per unit subsidy or something. The developers are very creative people. They'll figure out how to do that. And so you might get buildings that look a little different but are still going to fit into the neighborhoods.
Michael, why don't we it seems like a great idea to engage the design community in this conversation about how to get great design at a lower cost. So why don't we just have an RFP that says we're looking for high-quality design at the lowest possible cost, frame the outcomes, and my guess is that modular may end up being a very competitive approach, but there could be a lot. Why don't we challenge the market to come forward and be very explicit that we want high-quality design at the lowest possible cost and let an RFP test some of these assumptions?
Thank you, Commissioner. I think that's a terrific idea, and at the Trust, we're proposing to do exactly that this fall. We're talking about rolling out an RFP that basically poses a puzzle to development teams, bring us a design meeting certain criteria around quality, durability, and other social goals at the lowest possible subsidy. And we've tried to define the challenge very narrowly so that we can attract maximum creativity. And we're talking with all our public partners, including Portland Housing Bureau, Oregon Housing, Multnomah County, and other folks who might have some flexible funding that would align with that. So,
the other thing I think it's worth keeping in mind is when the public comes to either the county or the city, folks don't say we want an ugly school made out of crappy materials. They don't say we want a library that doesn't fit within the neighborhood and we're ashamed of. People don't advocate to use public dollars to create something that is not contextual or doesn't raise the community. And the irony is the housing that Habitat and Reach and Innovative and Home Forward and others do east of 82nd Street is not the housing we get the complaints about. When we get a complaint about shoddy construction, about an eyesore, about something that's zoned in a way that doesn't relate to the sidewalk or the street, 9 times out of 10, they're talking about private market housing that was just thrown up and continues to be a drag on the community. The stuff that we're investing in, and yes, there's a premium, I guess, for having something that fits the community expectations. The fact is, that's not what's catching the flack out in neighborhoods. And I think if you showed people the typical Habitat or Innovative or Reach development, they say, yeah, I'd love to have that in my neighborhood. It's this other crap I'd like you to deal with. And the crap is what we're actually spending money on, sending inspectors and talking to landlords that don't apparently understand the code. So there is a tension. But I would hate to see that, particularly in underserved parts of the community, we start lowering standards. Because I think people who live in areas of the city that haven't gotten their fair share of investment deserve to have beautiful schools and functional libraries and affordable housing that they can be proud of, and the fact that they may someday be proud to live in and not see as somehow other.
I appreciate the comment, Commissioner. I have a Reach project right down the street from my house that's a beautiful building that really adds to the neighborhood, so I know what you're talking about. I think the other thing about design, coming back to the concept of innovation that we talked about a little bit, was can we literally think outside the box a little bit and rethink what housing looks like, and are there radical approaches to getting the cost down? And I came in with a lot of enthusiasm around that when we started the work group and was rapidly talked down from that, partly because, again, you need the lenders to be on board, and the banks like to fund things where they can go and look at one that somebody's already done and it's cash flowing and it's working and the risk is manageable, and it's hard to do that if you're talking about something really radically different. But one really easy way to lower costs, at least for single adults, is build units that don't have their own bathroom or their own kitchen. And we've sort of stopped doing what some people call SROs, or single resident occupancy, and those kinds of models, and I don't completely understand why. And so that's another angle on the design question, is rethinking what housing could look like.
Well, I want to weigh in on that, though. I hope you haven't been completely talked out of that proposition, and I think we should continue that part of the conversation beyond just this work session. Because the conventional wisdom is not always wise. We have fought a long-running battle, which apparently continues to this day. I was just over at the building that Eric Lemelson's doing on Vancouver Avenue, and those folks were talking about how they're still fighting the battle about parking. We've been fighting the battle about parking for years. That the lenders, have been shaping development by form following parking. As it turns out, in an urban environment, we need a lot less parking for cars and a lot more for bicycles than we thought we did. And I think as Jill will attest, in a lot of projects where the city has a minimum for bike parking, the developers are overbuilding it by a factor of 2 to 1 because they know what the demand is. So these things change. And the market acceptability of things like row houses has changed. So, or like row houses with a front porch and no parking, which I was in a couple of last week. So I guess I want us to keep thinking creatively even while we assert the points that we're hearing today, which is, you know, long-term cost-benefit matters. You're right, Nick, the pressure, if anything, not just in East Portland but across the city, is for a higher level of performance and design than people see in market rate development today. We're hearing that a lot from neighborhoods. We have an infill task force meeting this afternoon. That's one of their topics, which is, you know, how do we, if we're going to add density to the city, how do we do it in a way that it respects the neighborhood pattern and form? And people are really hungry for that. So it's a challenge, but I guess I want to keep pushing that design and creativity envelope, seeing a few of the things that I've seen. Every now and then, there's something new under the sun.
Comment on that. You know, I don't think we have to sacrifice amenities like bathrooms and kitchens. I'll give you an example of a project we just finished on 171st and Division. And one of our units is a micro unit, rents for $395, about 30% MFI. And the whole complex was rented up in about 3 weeks, and with 200 people waiting in the wings, wish we could build more. And it's you know, we were able to put a washer and dryer and a bathroom and granite countertops and a lot of amenities that you would find in market-rate units, but we were smart about how we fit it into the complex and priced it right, and we had more demand for that product than we could ever imagine. So I think we can still provide quality and the amenities that people expect.
Comment, Dave. So I'm going to turn to our recommendations now. We have roughly 20 recommendations in the final report. I highlight sort of the top 7 in the next few slides, but first I want to cover just a few caveats. And I think the council has pretty admirably anticipated most of these. If you a really simple-minded, exclusive focus on lowering costs would be a really bad idea for a variety of reasons. You would exclude high-opportunity neighborhoods where the land is more expensive. We've talked a lot about cutting corners up front. I think we all understand you don't want to do that. Very low-income households are going to need more subsidy to get to affordability, so those projects will cost more, and if we want to help those folks, we need to be prepared for that. And, we were just really talking about if you really went for really cheap boxes, you would really inflame neighborhood resistance to these projects, and nobody really wants to do that. And then, so let's not forget the benefits of the affordable housing we're building, too. We're building more than just storage units for humans. We're building pieces that are permanent additions to the community. So with all that, I think I might skip lightly over the 7 recommendations we highlight and get to the ones that pertain to the city specifically, unless there are some that you want to call out and talk about.
The wage rate issue is a bully issue, but it's still something the city could impact.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Kurt was just suggesting you might want to talk about the number 5 there on slide 8. It's the 18th slide, so it should be at the bottom of page 9 there. The prevailing wage issue with Bureau of Labor and Industries, there were really 2 issues, I think, that came out in that discussion. One was the one we've already talked about with commercial wage rates on mixed-use projects, especially if you've got a 3-over-1 or 4-over-1 and there's a space for a coffee shop in the corner of the first floor, that essentially paints the whole project as a commercial project, and that adds a significant premium to your wages. And if we could get Boley to comfortable with the idea of split wage determinations where the commercial wage rate applies to the commercial part of the project and residential applies to the rest, people felt that would be a major advance.
Can we pause on that for a minute? Because I did mention that as well. I'm glad you're touching on it. And that is, what does the city need to do to set that decision in motion? Do we need to make a formal request to Boley? Talk a little bit about the mechanics.
I think it's a labor commissioner interpretation. Is of the yards at Union Station is the City of Portland's largest TOD project, and it was built by Skip Grodal, GSL Properties. I think Walsh did the first phase. The first phase was sold to the Housing Authority of Portland, now Home Forward. But the first phases of the yards were a split wage determination. The last phase, Block 5, was a commercial wage rate project.
Really?
Even though there are no commercial amenities on the ground floor, there's a leasing office and there is a community room, but the entire building was determined to apply as a commercial wage rate. So there has been a bit of mission creep, if you will, as the labor commissioner is advocating for labor. I don't want to obscure that fact. The name of the agency is includes labor. But it is contemplated in your comprehensive plan that we're going to increase the supply of mixed-use projects. And if we have to labor under this wage rate determination, we may not reach our goals.
Yeah, and that intersects with the design issue again, because we're hearing an increasing concern about the Main Street, you know, projects on Main Streets, I mean, that have apartments all the way down to the sidewalk as opposed to ground floor retail. And in terms of neighborhood quality of life, people prefer retail. Well, if it's radically more expensive to cost in cost per square foot, then that's another drag.
Are those case-by-case decisions by the labor commissioner?
I think it's evolved as a policy at the present. I think that's the current policy, although I think anybody with the time and money can appeal that decision. The time involved and the expense is such that people usually don't bother. There have been some determinations where, you know, the ground floor is a partial floor, perhaps due to a sloping site, so you don't have a complete floor, where that those kinds of determinations have been made. But I think everyone recognizes that the steel-reinforced concrete ground floor of a podium is a commercial construction typology, and that should be bid as such. The lightweight frame construction, usually wood, sometimes lightweight steel, is a different typology entirely, and it should be bid separately, and the wage rate should be done separately. The contractor, the general contractor, often will have a specialty contractor doing the framing separately from the podium itself, which is a more complex, usually a steel-reinforced structure. So I think it's a wage rate determination that would perhaps require the city to ask the labor commissioner to review that policy and to work with the city on perhaps a wage rate that would be split, applied to the city of Portland and other core urban areas of the Willamette Valley.
I might know that there is, thank you, there's a, thank you. Commissioner Jules Bailey, Multnomah County. There's a little bit of legislative history on this, couple sessions on this particular issue. I don't have it at my fingertips, but I'm sure your crack government relations staff can brief you on it.
Okay. Thank you. Might be one for us to talk about before the next session.
And I think the other thing that people called out with Bowley was just more prompt and reliable wage determinations. I think there's an issue where you can get a determination at the very front end of a project, and then when you get to ready to actually build it, it's changed, and you get different numbers, and that throws the pro forma off. And I'm sure that's a subtle and sensitive topic. I don't know if you have anything more to add to that one. So being able to rely on that first determination would make a huge difference. Okay. So really, I think we're at the sort of money slide here, which is the role of local government, and in this case, the city of Portland. We called out several recommendations specifically relevant to the city, and there are a couple more that I've written down that have come up in conversation that I think are really important I should have added to begin with. So the first one is the Bureau could reward cost-efficient development in funding decisions. And so I know PHB, as Oregon Housing has started to look more and more at cost, partly because they've been hearing from their partners things are too expensive. So they've been trying to prioritize this. So we just wanted to cheer on that effort. And again, I guess, you know, for me, the takeaway at the end of this process was the creativity lives with the developer teams. If you put them on the case of lowering costs, they can figure out how to do that. Right now, we're not really telling them loudly and clearly that that's important. Coordinate and align with other funders as much as possible, things like processes and criteria, the reports you require, the compliance you require. This is hard stuff and not easy to figure out how you do it, and as soon as you get coordinated, somebody will change in a couple of years, and you'll have to coordinate all over again. But if you could streamline, combine, align processes at all, you would make life easier for developers. I think Mike or one of the other contractors brought up the threshold for workforce training requirements is really low, and we might want to look at that. I think it's currently $250,000 project triggers workforce training requirements, and that does have some cost implications.
Isn't that an equity issue?
I think it is an equity issue, and I think that was the we're flagging that as a cost driver that we might want to look at.
How does that comport with our values that we discussed about earlier?
Raising the value to $500,000 or $1 million would substantially change that equation on projects.
I think there may be opportunity, and I don't have the answer to this, but in discussions with general contractors, there may be more cost-effective ways to achieve the underlying goals. So in other words, I don't think it's a question of the contractor or developer community not wanting to have the workforce and apprenticeship and that learning, but it does seem like what's happening is, to meet the requirement in some cases, as Mike explained, they're not assuming any productivity for that person, which may or may not be the case, and also that person might not be getting like the full experience that's really allowing them to learn, you know, in terms of what they're doing. So I think, while I don't have an answer, I think it would be worth perhaps bringing people to the table to go back to, like, what are we trying to accomplish, which is training and opportunities for people, and is there perhaps a different way we can do that that is also ends up being less costly?
Yeah, I think that is a conversation to be had, you know, and then you brought up, are they doing any work? It could be said that at certain points they're doing the same amount of work at far less cost. So that, I think, is something that needs to be evaluated, and it probably depends on the apprentice and the stage that they are in their work development.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. We talked about green building, and this is an interesting conversation because there are a variety of different ways you can certify your project as green. Just building to the city's code at this point gets you pretty darn close to LEED Silver, is my understanding. So I think as an industry, we understand a lot about what sorts of things get you long-term durability that pay off in terms of energy savings and water savings down the road in a reasonable period of time, materials that don't make your tenants ill, for instance, all those things that factor into green building. And it's really the certification project. I think LEED is the poster child here of getting the glass plaque is an expensive process unto itself. You have to hire a consultant essentially to walk you through that process. Are there less expensive ways to get to the same result? It's really Jill's comment on the other issues. Can we get to the same goal that we all share, which is certifying that this thing is sustainable and green in all the ways that we mean that, at a lower cost? And so we were looking at, there are different models for this. Could there be a one-page or two-page green checklist for Oregon affordable housing projects? I think that's a complicated issue, and we've just begun to sort of get into that, but we intend to pursue that. Design review is probably the biggest...
Do you have a question?
Design review is a really difficult and complex issue in this conversation, but and maybe I should defer to Jill and Jessica, who've had some experience with this, but there are particular decisions that you can get from the Design Commission that will drive up your costs in a pretty straightforward way, and I think there's an important conversation to have about understanding that those decisions, criteria that we're using, expectations we have, do have a cost increment, and there's no funding source to pay for that. So essentially, you're going to get fewer units if you have the bar at a very high place. And there may be ways to develop really attractive projects with things like hardy siding, for instance. I think there's a particular issue Kurt was telling me about recently with where the Design Commission didn't really like hardy siding. And there are ways, I think, I've been told, that you can use that, get to an attractive result that's durable and appealing, and so we wanted to bring that up. There are other issues, I think, with the process, how neighbors get involved in projects. I think it is important for neighbors to be able to comment on projects as they come through. One of the concerns I heard loud and clear from the work group is, let's not hold affordable housing to a higher standard than the market rate housing. If we're going to have these processes, let's find ways to cope with the resistance that is just resistance to affordable housing, period, not really resistance to the way the building looks. So a complicated topic. The last two I'll mention that are not on the slide, and we should come back to the design review one, are parking, which the mayor mentioned, is really, really important, really adds cost. It's not free to create a parking space. And land banking, I think Commissioner Fish brought up the land cost issue. That's a really great addition to this list. As Kurt said, getting out ahead of the rising land costs can be a really important strategy for holding down costs in the future. With that, I think I'll open up this conversation of things the city has control over.
I'll just backfill the issue about design review. As mentioned, the Housing Bureau has cost containment strategies, and we underwrite projects according to those standards. We make awards of funding. The applicants then obtain their necessary building permits. And one challenge with design review in Portland is it comes quite late in the process. So we've already made it an underwriting decision. We know a project meets the standards, and we're starting to see projects fall out of compliance with our cost containment strategies once they get to design review. The St. Francis Park project, which is a co-development of Catholic Archdiocese property, controlled by Catholic Charities, co-developed by their developer Home Forward, was rebuffed at design review with a hardy siding. It's a cementitious board, comes in different dimensions, often lap siding to replace something that looks like cedar from a distance. But it's a very durable material and quite expensive to install because it takes special saws, and the dust that it produces has to be controlled. So that particular project does not currently meet our cost containment guidelines because they are having to comply with the Design Commission. They've been asked to consider, not required, but they've asked to consider decks being added to the project, which is also a redesign. So the ambiguity, perhaps arbitrary nature of design review is putting a burden on developers, and I want you to know that that's a cost to the public. We're paying for those changes. I know you hear from private developers about cost delays and cost shifts. That's their burden in life. That's their cost of doing business. But I think it might deserve special attention since we're paying for those changes. The other thing that I've heard from developers about is the design review is not a time-certain process. It can be an open-ended series of hearings before you get to yes. And that is enormously challenging for anybody to price in terms of their risk and exposure. And then finally, and it's connected to the open-ended process, is standing amongst folks that testify at design commissions is wide open. You can have people that don't live in the neighborhood but travel through the neighborhood, have a passing interest in the particular site. And from one meeting to the next, those folks might change. So you might think you have, yes, new people come into the hearing, new expectations are placed on the project as a result. So standing, the cost as a factor in design deliberations and a time-certain process seem to be the three major points of contention.
Yeah, let me just touch on that one quickly because I think this is an issue for all of us in terms of policy, but then an issue for Commissioner Saltzman in particular because of the way the BDS process works with that. You know, we have these amazing citizens who volunteer to be on the Design Commission, and we're overworking them because of the pace of development that's going on. But we also do tend to have fairly protracted proceedings. We had an appeal the other day on a project which the council ultimately unanimously approved, but I believe it had been through three design advice request hearings and two design review hearings at the commission, in addition to staff review and everything else. So great project, turned out great. It's going to be, you know, a credit to the city, but wow, that's a process cost there and a human cost in terms of the volunteers who are serving on the design commission. So I don't have a snappy answer for how we make that system, you know, swifter but still good. But that certainly is the goal. And one notion I just want to throw out, and we can talk about it more later, is you know, should there be a special track in terms of always doing a single design advice request hearing for an affordable housing project? Don't know. In other words, if we knew there was only going to be one DAR hearing and you got the issues worked out and then you went into design review, maybe something like that would help all involved. But again, the level of expectation of quality that we're hearing from the community is high. Honestly, it's higher than now.
Yeah, and these whole issues about design review are definitely, as Kurt indicated, on our radar, and certainly it's a conversation that needs to occur with, you know, with the Design Commission members and others who do have a, you know, a strong interest in these issues. So yeah, these types of ideas are on our radar for sure.
I'm curious if anybody would hazard a guess as to sort of the maximum possible savings of the city doing the cheapest thing on these issues where we have the most control. I mean, Mike said earlier that the lead requirements can add anywhere from 1% to 12% to the cost of the project. But what about sort of the average for that plus the average for these other costs? Like if we said we will have no workforce training requirements and no design review and no green building requirements, on average, what do people think that the reduction would be in the cost of an affordable housing project?
Dave might have a thought about that.
Yeah, I think that would be my number. I mean, if on the construction cost side, if you took out the green overlay, if you took out the prevailing wage overlay, depending on how far you were going with green.
Actually, I wasn't talking about prevailing wage because that's not something that we have unique, you know, the city itself controls. I was just thinking about the workforce training requirements, the green building requirements, and the design review requirements.
Yeah, then that increment's going to be quite a bit lower, maybe in the order of 5 to 10%.
Okay. Thank you.
Agree with that, Dave?
I think it's worth mentioning that the comprehensive plan does contemplate expanding the areas of the city where design review will apply. And as planning and sustainability is bringing that forward, being clear about the standards to which BDS and the Design Commission then review might have to be more nuanced. You have some heritage neighborhoods, the Lads Edition comes to mind, where you have a particular typology, a particular quality that is needs to be protected and respected. You have other fringe neighborhoods, and I think St. Francis Park is actually an example where it adjoins an industrial area. The 10th and Belmont site that Killian Pacific brought forward, the Goat Blocks, is another example where it adjoins a residential neighborhood, but it's bordered on three sides by a commercial and industrial property. The context was probably not that significant in terms of design quality. I think what triggered the Goat Blocks was the super block status. Since it was a two-block site, you had mid-block pedestrian connectivity that was required and triggered design review. So I think maybe a tiered approach. I wouldn't be the last person to advocate for affordable housing not adhering to design standards. I think neighborhoods would perhaps find an organizing cause, if you will, to fight affordable housing generally. That would be an unintended consequence. I think developers and owners of affordable housing are by and large very proud of their product. They want it to sparkle and shine. They want it to be an asset for the neighborhood. But having more predictability is, I think, the key. If the Design Commission were given some standards that included cost, so that they themselves had a burden to address cost, then it should reduce the number of appeals that you get.
So that really concludes what I expected to present to you. Happy to take any questions and appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you all very much. That's been a very good discussion. And
other questions or points to follow up on?
I guess one comment, Mayor. I think this is one of the best briefings we've ever had on housing issues generally and on affordability. And it's, I think you've also taken a very complicated subject and you've made it accessible. So thank you for your good work. And obviously the work that Meyer is doing is crucial. And so let's put this in context for a second. You've given us some food for thought, some provocative ideas and some probably achievable ideas for how we can lower costs. And I think we're duty-bound to find ways to lower costs. And I, for one, love the idea that you're looking at a demonstration pilot funding in the fall, because I think we should challenge the market to respond to some of the things we want to test and then see how they respond. And I'm hoping modular housing that's assembled in distressed parts of rural Oregon becomes an idea to beat, because I like the urban-rural component of that. But let's put this in a bigger context. We may be able to find a way to reduce our cost by 5 or 10% without sacrificing values that the city council has said are very important, and the community, more importantly, has said is very important. All right, so that's getting more value out of the limited pot we have, but let's put this in the bigger context, Kurt. Under the comp plan, as you read it, as I read it, we're going to have to add 2,000 units a year for the next, well, probably the rest of our natural lives to the inventory. So that's a huge challenge. We're not even close to that. Reducing our costs in how we do new construction is a tool, because we'll stretch those dollars. But the macro trends are not working to our favor. Federal funds are declining, and recently the Senate Committee on Jurisdiction voted to essentially defund the HOME program. And between CDBG, HOME, HOPWA, a few other accounts, Section 8, we have a limited set of federal tools, and I think the trend lines are not going our way. In fact, the whole question of whether we should have a HUD is being debated. So let's say that's even a more ominous signal, a sign on the horizon. So federal funds are declining. Our TIF, available TIF resources, tax increment finance resources, are on a steady decline. The five-year forecast for your bureau shows that in 2 years, the budget of your bureau is down to $50 million, which is a 50% reduction. And it is almost exclusively attributed to the fact that there's a huge downturn in available TIF resources, and then we go over what's called the TIF cliff. So we have limited ways in which we can fill the gap. Commissioner Saltzman has proposed some voluntary incentive mechanisms, particularly around the zoning code. That's going to get us some units, but it's not going to get us 2,000. So at some point, we've lowered costs. We've contemplated reduced federal funding unless a miracle happens. We're looking at a TIF cliff. And there's only so much the city and the county can do with their general funds. I guess sooner rather than later, I think this council would benefit from what are the revenue needs to fund 2,000 units. Build in a reasonable assumption around cutting costs. Build in a reasonable forecast of the TIF cliff. Let's assume that there's no great break in the stalemate in Washington over affordable housing, so we continue to have budgets impacted by sequestration. But if we're about to subscribe to the notion that we have to add 2,000 units a year, we're going to have to come up with something dramatic in terms of resources to allow you to do that. And it seems to me the only on the horizon, you're going to come back to us soon. We're going to have a discussion about whether to bump up the 30% set aside. That's a timely discussion because that's one of our most robust tools to build housing. We're going to have a community-wide discussion about a dedicated funding source and how we might do that with an eye towards next fall, and Deborah's leading the charge on that. But in the short term, what I'm hearing as I look at this excellent presentation is we're going to have an interim funding source that's flexible, that allows you to do the good things you want to do. Because the one thing I take away from this presentation is if you had your choice, you'd rather have a flexible dollar over a federal dollar or even a TIF dollar. You want the most flexible dollar possible, which I think is the what Dan has contemplated in terms of the HIF, Housing Investment Fund, putting general fund dollars with as few restrictions as possible and recycling those dollars. So whatever it is, I think we should have a sooner rather than later a roadmap as to the resources you need to meet the comp plan goal of 2,000 units a year. And I hope that the council puts at the top of its agenda going into the budget, putting a big chunk of general fund dollars into a HIF, into some flexible spending source to test drive some of the ideas you're bringing to us about how to get more production on the ground.
One other potential source, and I think we're starting to see some social responsible investment from the private sector starting to come into play, and which we've had some conversation about. It's a great way to leverage not only government money, bank money along with private money, gets you a long ways towards being able to close some of these gaps.
Thank you. This has been a very helpful discussion. I'm wondering how it fits in with the consolidated plan and the work that Home Forward and Home for Everyone are doing could we get a presentation on that at some point, please?
That's a fine idea. Chair was about to speak, and I bet she and I and Commissioner Saltzman and Chair Commissioner Bailey could put that together with Mark Jolin's help in fairly short order.
I think that would be very doable, and I would just want to tag along Commissioner Fish's comments and say that although we like to have studies and conversations, I think what the takeaway for me is on this is there is a crisis out there. There is, you know, we are going to hear from our friends from Community Alliance of Tenants today with their renter's emergency, and that doing something, and maybe not, even if it is only reducing the cost 10, 15, 20%, doing something is so much better than doing nothing. So I would just encourage us all. I appreciate it. I'm really excited, Michael, for your innovative conversation with your RFP, and really I want to help whatever ways we can at the county. We did put $5 million of county general fund this year for the first time into an innovative fund to get at the same conversation that you're having. And just because we know that we can't be here 2 years from now having the same conversation.
So it might be useful just for a moment to sketch how those dollars are getting out the door through RFPs in both cases, just so people know. So.
Yeah, we'll be releasing our plan fairly soon on how the money is going to be dispersed.
And the demonstration project RFP goes out when?
Well, we're trying to make sure we don't trip over the efforts of the county and the city and Oregon Housing. So I'm still having conversations to make sure that what we're doing supports what they're trying to do. We are thinking of a pre-development RFP that would go out in the next couple of months that would really try and spur some ideas that are innovative, replicable, and actually buildable by 2018 that could align with what the other funders are doing and spur broader interest and develop some new models that lenders and others would get on board with.
Anything else?
Staff have been working directly with Michael to see if we can merge without encumbering the private funds, but if we can merge HIF dollars to make a little bit more impact. We've also talked with Ms. Madrigal at the county about doing the same thing. So we think there might be a way to get a multiplier effect and to leverage some funds without necessarily limiting your scope. We also are in parallel doing some strategic land banking in places like North and Northeast Portland, which have obviously rapidly gentrifying areas. And frankly, the North Northeast Oversight Committee is meeting right now today. So we'll have a report this afternoon about how that's proceeding. A portion of our funds need to be going into the short-term land banking. This is for that 36-month pre-development period to take land out of the speculative market so that we don't chase affordability, that we actually attain it. And to Commissioner Fish's point, the Portland Housing Advisory Commission is meeting in retreat. It will be an opportunity for us to share with them at least our capital investment strategy for achieving the comprehensive plan goals. For those that haven't read the entire comprehensive plan yet, there's 123,000 new housing units projected in the next 20 years. And of those, 10,000 would be permanently affordable, about 500 per year over that period of time. We currently have about 1,350 units in our pipeline. So we think that's an achievable number. But as mentioned, we have some of those funding sources that we have are subject to sequestration. The home program is subject to complete defunding. We will advocate for continued home dollars. We think that tax credits still have a place in this world. It is worth mentioning that a dollar of tax credits, given the current demand, is greater than a dollar of U.S. currency. Developers are getting about $1.20 per tax credit, which means that the cost and complexity is worth the effort. So we need all the resources, and we'd like to run it by the PHAC first before it comes to the council. With Commissioner Salzman's direction, I think the first opportunity would likely be the October 8th meeting where you talk about the housing element of the comprehensive plan so that we can put a number on the table to let you understand what the gap is, and that we can have a conversation about that at that time.
Well, again, I want to thank you all for this has been a very useful work session. I want to thank you especially, Chair Kapori, for being here. She has another government to run in her spare time, but we appreciate you investing so much time and effort in this partnership, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you all soon. Thank you very much.